SBS Audio is supported by advertising.
Need a few minutes to reset? Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
We acknowledge the people of Ngāitahu Iwi, of Te Wai Pōnamu, Aotearoa, who welcomed Alone Australia onto their land. And we acknowledge the Cammeraygal people as the traditional owners of the land we're recording on. We pay deepest respect to First Nations elders, past and present, and all First Nations people.
This episode speaks about mental health and references sexual abuse. If anything comes up for you, you can contact Lifeline on 13 11 14, Men's Line Australia on 1300 78 99 78, or the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander support line 13YARN on 13 92 76.
Welcome to Alone Australia, the podcast. I'm Gina Chick, winner of Season 1 of Alone Australia.
And I'm Darren Mara from SBS World News and also SBS Dateline.
You're hanging around while we watch Season 2 of Alone Australia with you week to week, and we're going to break down all the action on this podcast. It's your official companion to the show.
And later in Episode 2, we're going to chat to Leanne and Mike, who tapped out this episode. I can't wait to hear their insights on what went down. Okay, two exits, one fish. In this episode, we saw Leanne and Mike both tap out. They both made exits. How do you feel about seeing them both go?
It's always heartbreaking seeing people tap out, but I also find it really interesting to see the reasons that they do. With Mike, it was obviously a medical episode and, you know, we could really see his fear.
He was scared.
Yeah, poor love. And it's a long way. Like it's like out there in the dark alone with knowing that's a long time to get help. That's a scary thing when there's a medical episode. And then with Leanne, we've got the very obvious realization she has that family is her survival item. And like, I really loved seeing how she listened to that internal authority and made the choice to go in her own rightness.
At least she's got bragging rights over Rob.
Forever and ever.
We saw some of the participants start foraging. Andreas went out, he turned his underpants into an actual nutsack. But he did bear some fruit, so to speak. He found miro berries and mamaku ferns. I mean, that's going to be pretty useful for him to know that that's nearby.
Yeah, yeah. And what we see is also something that I find to be quite true about bush food, which is it generally tastes like shit. He can go through all of the huge emotional and mental lift of discovering there's food on the landscape and going, oh my God, this is fabulous. And then you've got to make a fire and cook it up. And there's like,
what does it taste like? It just tastes like
dirt and sticks in general. Or you might have a little fruit, and we're used to our giant strawberries and our huge watermelons and, you know, our fruit that you get from the supermarket. Whereas when it's a bush food, it might be a berry the size of half your fingernail and most of its seed, and it's more of a homeopathic effect rather than a nutritional one. But it is a huge psychological lift when you find food.
Mm-hmm. We saw Andreas and Chase actually go out hunting. No luck on the land. What's the benefit of going for a deer rather than going fishing, for example, or would you go the other way around?
My strategy would always be to go for whatever is going to be the easiest. Like for me, conservation of energy is the number one law of survival. Like you need to look at your calories in and your calories out. It's simple maths. So splurging a whole bunch of energy, tromping through landscape that's so thick you can't find your way through it, to possibly stagger upon a deer in your first 2 days when you haven't figured out where they all are yet. I mean, that's a lot. Whereas you got a lake that's right there and there's worms in the ground. And as we saw with Chase, you know, he had multiple lines out and all he had to do was sit and watch them.
Mm.
You got to be bored, but... Mm. you know, it paid off. He ended up with a fish. And I've got to say, I'm like watching him catch that fish. It's like, that is four times the size.
I'm getting so, sitting next to you watching these episodes, I'm getting so much resentment from you. I don't blame you either.
Look, every alone has its challenges, but seeing how much food is actually there, you're getting the blue version. Like, you bastards, you got that giant fish. It's four times the size of anything that guy pulled out of the water.
Well, it's certainly a land of abundance, New Zealand, isn't it?
Looks like it, yeah. It looks like there's going to be game. I'm a bit excited to see who's going to pull in what. And if we're getting a fish that size after only 5 days, I reckon there's a good chance that once people hook into the fishing, that that will keep them sustained while they then crack into the hunting.
Oh, so you'd complement the fishing with the hunting?
Absolutely. Like, really, you want to have as many strategies as you can out there, because the thing is that the fish, they change their bite depending on what the weather's doing, what the air pressure's doing, you know, what their breeding cycle's doing. Trout, when they're shagging, they're not eating. So if they're breeding, they go off the bite. And it's winter, so they're probably breeding. So, yeah, having one avenue of food production is basically just to get yourself set up so that you can then use that as a base to move into big game and gathering.
Let's talk a bit more about the land. When we saw Andreas and Chase go out hunting, it looks dense. That's like a calorie burner right there, right?
It is so brutal. There's so much about this landscape that reminds me of where I was in Lutruwita. It's different, but it's the same level of density, the wet, soggy, lots of moss, having to fight through bush that's so dense that every time you move through that kind of bush, the trees above dump all of their rain on you. So it's just this constant rainfall. Everything's wet.
Cold. 1 to 2 degrees.
1 to 2 degrees. So it's pretty bitter. It's pretty cold. And the other thing is that this sunshine is a real issue. So it's said in this episode that they get, I think, 7 metres of rain.
7 metres in 200 days.
That's a lot of rain. That means there's a lot of cloud. That means there's not much sun.
How does that compare to Tassie?
So Tassie, we got 2.5 metres of rain a year. And that was, I reckon it all happened in the time that I was out there. I don't know how it's spread out for this lot. But because they've got these high mountains in Aotearoa and it's the New Zealand climate, so there's just so much more rain. Yeah, lack of sunshine, it's the kind of thing that actually makes people tap out, not having the sun.
Yeah, it seemed like a significant reason for Tamika to move camp. There was that shot of her on one bank in complete shade looking across the water at the other in complete sunshine. How do you rate her move, and particularly at this point?
Yeah, that move is super smart. I think if she'd stayed there, she would have been buggered. But because she moved early, like, you only want to move while you're still sort of fat and full of calories, really. Mm. Building a shelter is a huge calorie burn anyway, but moving 100 kilos of gear through that terrain, if she'd left it, it just probably would have been too much for her. But because she made the choice to do it early, it was a big call and a big choice, but it was a really, really smart move. And for her to now have sunshine, you could see how much drier her place is. I think she's really set herself up.
Episode one left us on a huge cliffhanger as resilience coach Mike was struggling with a bit of coughing and some chest pains. And this episode, we learned that Mike was pulled out with an extraction. We've got Mike sitting here with us. I want to start the chat by asking you, how afraid were you in those moments? What was going on?
What a way to start, mate. With a punch. I love it. I really appreciate it. Do you know what? It was probably one of the scariest moments I've ever experienced. And I mean that genuinely, because this may take a bit of time, but if I can explain the sequence of what happened, went to bed, would probably be in sleep about an hour. And then I woke with pains in my chest and I went, oh, pretty ordinary, you know, bit of a precursor from the earlier in the day. I got a little bit of pain there. I put that down to carrying that big log.
It was a big log.
It was a big log.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so that happened and then it dissipated after about 10 minutes. I went, that's interesting. 20 minutes, 30 minutes later, it happened again, a little more intensity. Probably 40 minutes after that, it happened again with a huge intensity, like a pain I'd never really felt before. But it wasn't this. Yes, I have felt pain before, and that's probably telling fibs, but it was a pain in an area that I hadn't felt before, that being in my chest. And I'd had all the tests prior. And that's a great part about the protocol you have to satisfy coming into the show. You have to prove that you're fit. And I had apparently done that. So I'm thinking to myself, I'm fine. I can handle this, work through the pain, which is actually leaving the production has given me a chance to go, wow, don't be so silly. So the fourth episode, well, sorry, after the third episode, I'm lying there thinking, wow, there's a little more intensity to this. I know how long it's going to take for them to get out to me. If I have my heart attack, they won't know till 10 o'clock in the morning because my GPS hasn't moved. I go, why hasn't it moved? Get someone out there to find what Mike's doing. Too late. So the anxiety factor had kicked in then. So add anxiety to the scared factor that I might never see my kids again. Mate, I was, to answer your original question, very, very scared. Mm. I really was.
And you sort of touched upon it there. You were not listening to your body. You were ignoring what your body was telling you, what your body was sort of screaming out at you.
Yeah, silly, isn't it, mate? Yeah. And once again, I suppose that's all part of the processing when you leave the production and your processing is firstly failure. Now, I'm only saying failure because that's what I've conjured in my mind. It's not necessarily failure to everybody else, but to me it was failure because I had set myself a standard and 60 years of age, 60 days, that's the minimum benchmark. We'll see what happens after that. And I'd said that to people as part of the production, you know, to then, and also to be asked, what do you think could force you to tap out? And I was saying nothing. I would have to be medevaced out. And then for it to happen within 48 hours, the processing of that perceived failure for me was really quite profound. It also leads into why I did the show in the first place. And that was, the whole thing was about a journey of self-growth for me. That's really what it was. Testing myself, but seeing how I can evolve as a person.
It's interesting, isn't it? There's that idea of you don't always get what we want, but we get what we need. And when you say that you know, the reason that you were doing this was for self-growth, and here you're presented with a situation that is going to, you know, really push you up against your ideas about what's a success and what's a failure and how you are in the world. I'd love to kind of like unpack like the journey from the event and then the realizations that you've had since then. In that moment, did it bring into focus what's important for you?
Gee, I'm so glad you asked that because it now gives me a chance to divulge and maybe indulge. You're right. What gets thrown up at you is quite amazing in that, how am I now going to process failure? And we've mentioned failure again already. And once again, that's only failure in my mind, but it's there. And for me then to come back knowing that my beautiful eldest boy, he's running the business. He had a plan that he would be there for at least 2 months running it by himself. The kids weren't expecting me back. There are other aspects of my life. People weren't expecting me back. For then for me to make the phone call, say, g'day, mate, I'm coming home. And his first response is, are you okay? Second response is, oh, no. Because it's not just me that's impacted. It's the other people that are impacted. And I'll just answer what you've asked in two parts. The first part is that when I did come back, I chose to actually go and live the alone experience myself anyhow, without the cameras. I went away. I went and lived in the bush. I went and hunted in the bush at a good mate's farm, great, my dear best mate's farm between Tamworth and Armidale. And I was able to do it as part of a healing process because what was my original reason for going on in the first place? Self-growth. Well, then why do I need the cameras to do it? Let's just go and experience that continuing self-growth. Beautiful. And that's pretty well part one answered in a nutshell. The second part is what happened as a result of failure. And I'm putting that in inverted commas. What happened is I had to process and compartmentalize the learnings that were being confronted, I was being confronted by, based on the fact that it was expectations I'd imposed upon myself, not placed, I'd imposed these expectations. So what are the learnings from that? Well, I think the greatest learning was that you like who you are. If you're going on a program like this to receive an organic learning, then by coming back and taking different learnings, not the ones you thought you were going to learn, but the ones about, hey, Mike Hayes, how are you going to process failure? It's important you park your ego. Why did you do it in the first place? What growths have occurred? And the growths, Gina, have been incredible in that you have aha moments and you think, yeah, I like that because I learned that ego can be parked, firstly, but also the lessons I can take that are organic and let me grow as a person continuing down the track, if that makes sense. The show for me was about continuing growth. I learned to grow in other areas of my life based on the fact that I was medevaced out within 2 days. Simple as that.
As you're being extracted, there's this beautiful piece where you say that you're sick of being the tough guy. You're tired of being the tough guy. And the thing that I really love about that, and it's like you said, it's just like it's a very stark way to kind of run into that lesson, is that there's so much of your history just in that one very heartfelt moment. And what I saw was that you were changing your relationship with knowing your limits. And what I wanted to know is, like, how have you overridden your limits in your life, and how is that different now?
I'm sniffing because I'm getting a bit emotional. I can relive that moment as if it was yesterday, because we all get these things thrown up at us in life, and I have no hesitation in sharing that. You know, I unfortunately suffered sexual abuse at boarding school, and with that comes a loss of innocence, and with that you tend to live a life of guilt, you know. So what do you do to handle the guilt? And then to express manhood, you participate in a sport like rugby, which I have just been so grateful for. But rugby was a conduit for me to express my manhood, good, bad, or indifferent. I've got lifelong friends from it. However, it was physicality that I was able to tap into. So once again, you're expressing your manliness by playing rugby. You know, I lost my first son. You know all about that, you beautiful person. I lost my first son. So there's all the associated, you know, emotional challenges with that, both with his beautiful mum too. We both experienced that. And then you experience separation, you experience divorce, you experience, and I don't mind saying it, I experienced bankruptcy as well as a result of being able to try and cope. So how do you deal with all this? Well, you nailed it. I dealt with it by being as manly as I possibly could and showing stoicism and showing strength, raising the kids in a way that I wanted to create a sanctuary for the kids. And sorry, I'm sniffing because it did trigger me to start with. That particular scene, and as I say, I can see it like it was yesterday, was like this. I was so scared, but now I was in comfort by having people around me and medical help with me, that it all just melted away in that one instant, to the point where I went, I was tired. Mm-hmm. I was really tired. I was tired of always trying to show this strength when maybe it was more about vulnerability and accepting that, guess what, you don't have to be this person. And I reckon that's really been a huge part of this ongoing growth now. And I hope that if there's some people watching this show, that they are able to celebrate a similar experience and know that they are also capable of letting go, or even then maybe continuing on a path of growth. Then if that happens, then what a blessing. So there, let's look at failure and say, hey, there's some great blessings to come out of that.
I'd like to know what your personal alone experience after the show, when you went out, what role that played carrying on from the expression of your vulnerability towards, in episode two. I mean, how did that carry on? How did you process that when you spent all that time now really alone without cameras?
Yeah, I think that was the greatest healing time for me, because when you're actually out there by yourself, not having to worry about the cameras, you've even got more alone time. And it was really important for me during that time to sit in that place of initial confrontation, the challenge, and then to be able to make peace with that using nature, the elements. You know, I even think back at the time I was just trekking across a mountain, and then you feel a breeze. I close my eyes, you can feel a breeze kissing you on the face as it whispers across. And then at the same time, you're thinking, oh, am I upwind or am I downwind? You know, it's interesting. However, being able to live that moment of rawness and being organic was really an important part of that healing, because I had so much time for myself, maybe I could say almost selfishly, but it was time I needed. And it was really important for me because it allowed me to heal. And I had to heal, mate, because as I said, ego, failure, that time away was really important for healing.
It's something that I found to be really true going into Alone, and also having watched it and now being involved with the conversations with the participants here. And that is that nature breaks us all in the end. Like, no one leaves Alone without being humbled somehow. And we can come in with all of our ideas about ourselves. We can come in with our identities. We can come in with our plans and our strategies. And then we run into the mirror of nature and we see ourselves as we really are, rather than our picture of ourselves. And one of the interesting things for me is the journey that every individual has with that. Some resist it, some go with it. And I am so touched by your vulnerability, from going from saying that I had this manly way of being and that was it, to then be able to talk to us about these things that you've gone through and to really bear this your tender heart. What I'm wondering is, how has this new tenderness and this new vulnerability translated to your parenting? How is it going now with your kids?
Wow. I'm really glad you raised that, because I think it's a very relevant topic, not just with my own parenting, but with parenting in general. I also feel that I was on a path of this organic growth anyhow, because I was inspired by maybe the process of daily practice, of meditation, of being present, of being still. It's one that the kids may refer to as a tree-hugging rugby player who loves his own time and spirituality. And these are topics of conversation that have certainly pervaded our beautiful talks over the last, let's say, 10 years, maybe 15 years. And the kids know that it's part of their dad continuing growth. As a parent, I'd love to think that it has enabled them to see, especially with the production, humility. I also like them to think that as a parent, don't be afraid to give anything a go. I would also like them to understand that change is okay. You don't have to be set in a way that is society's norm or is accepted by society. I think that it's important to appreciate that your life's evolution is important, and change is an important part of that evolution. It's also important to understand that failure or lack of success is not a bad thing. It's an opportunity. You know, that's where some of our greatest lessons lie. And I hope that the kids have also been able to see that as well. And therefore, maybe if those lovely people who watch the show can also take a little bit of that with them and incorporate it as a practice in their life, or look at their own lives and say, you know, once again, if this bloke can do it, then maybe there's possibilities for me or us as well. So as from a parenting perspective, I see myself as an elder. I see myself in the role of imparting wisdom, but only imparting wisdom when asked. I'm not there to impose anymore. As elders, we sit, we watch, we observe, and when asked, let's just say, we give advice, and hopefully it's wisdom.
Drop the mic.
Beautiful words, mate. What was it like seeing your kids again once you got back home?
Great. My kids are my life. And I take parenting very seriously because becoming a dad was probably the most remarkable thing that's ever happened to me. And I loved the role of being a dad. I think what's important for me was wanting them to understand that I don't want to be put on a pedestal. You know, I don't want to be in a position where, you know, you look up to you look up at this person and go, wow, there's idolatry, there's, you know, there's this enormous love. But what's important for me in relation to the kids is they understand that their dad is also human. There is vulnerability. Don't put me on the pedestal. Please don't do that, because you're going to go through things in your life that I would love you to be able to discuss with me, but don't think you can discuss with me because I'm seen as someone higher. That's not where I sit, hopefully, in that role as a dad. I don't want to be best mates, because that's not the right thing either. The kids have got to have their friends that they can talk to as well. And I don't need to be privy to some of those conversations. However, it goes back to that elder status. If I'm there to be able to give that wisdom when asked, and hopefully it's the right wisdom. So seeing my kids when I came back was really beautiful, yet at the same time, it was important that I go away from the kids because they'd also processed the fact that I wasn't going to be there for 2 months. So, yeah.
Also, just touching on what you're mentioning there about showing vulnerability to your children, also, I suppose, communicating that it takes strength to be vulnerable. Mm. It takes strength to be courageous enough to admit vulnerability, I think, which is what a lot of men struggle with.
Yeah. Look, we have this stoicism that can be imposed. I'm the last of the baby boomers, mate. I've had wonderful maternal, paternal role models in my life with both my parents. And interestingly, I lost my beautiful mum 3 months after I came back. And this is what, Gina, you touched on earlier about what did the process allow? Well, the process of me leaving the show earlier allowed me to spend more time with my mum, which was, it's amazing how the universe works in that way. So the role modeling of both my parents was one of very much a generational thing from that era. And I'm grateful for that. Are they similar parenting styles to the ones I would like to adopt? No, because there are lessons that I've taken from that because of the generational differences. Yet I'd like to think that the learnings you take from that are ones that then you can hopefully are used for betterment, you know, are used for good as opposed to bad.
I've heard you say now the word failure half a dozen times. And each time I get this little jarring in my body. And I know you always say it's, you know, failure in inverted commas. But to me, it feels like one of the things that you've embodied in your journey through Alone is the turning inside out of the word failure. And I love to think of it as there's no mistakes, there are only lessons. And when we're faced with a lesson, we can crumble or we can turn it inside out. We can go, well, what's the blessing in the lesson kind of thing. And in 48 hours, you managed to take this life lesson. And since then, you have synthesized it into a book of wisdom that you have now given. And so to me, hearing failure seems like anathema, because all I see is victory. All I see is triumph. All I see is this beautiful resonant resilience and the lessons of an elder. And so I wonder if it's possible to actually get rid of the word failure completely.
Yeah, it is. And it's a lovely way to pre-frame, I think, the conversation, because the word failure has connotations. What you then do with that word is part of that processing. And I really appreciate you saying that, because we can. Let's get rid of that shackle of the term failure. Yeah, it's gone. And from the phoenix rises. That's right. We can get rid of that word failure because it allowed people to understand there's a baseline. Let's work from that baseline. To me, it is not failure, because once again, if I go back to what was the initial motivation, it was one of self-growth. Now, it didn't necessarily pan out the way I thought it was going to pan out. However, the learnings that have occurred as a result of only being out there for 48 hours. And let's just step back again, and you're fully aware of this as well. You get about 2 months' notice. From the minute you find out that you're one of the participants, your life changes then. So I'd love people to understand that. I'd love to think it's not just, oh, we're put out on Sunday and everything's hunky-dory. No, no, no. That's not how it is. Your eating habits change. Your mindset changes. Your preparation changes. You can even become a little bit selfish. You become a little bit insular as you prepare for the program. And you know this. You've been there. So there is a lot that happens before you, our wonderful viewers see it for the first time. Even going into, let's call it the boot camp, where you're experiencing the camera training, you're experiencing an induction to land, you're experiencing even the personalities of the people. And it's really interesting, and once again, you know this. When you first land there, you look at the other participants, go, well, what's the competition like? Within 24 hours, what happens? You're not competing against anyone. The thing is that you don't compete with anyone except yourself, and it only takes 24 hours to realize that, because you're all on the same journey together. So let's go back to this word failure. And this, they've just taken that jacket off. The failure jacket's gone. What are the learnings? What are the successes? They are, I like myself even more. I want to grow to love myself, and I will grow to love myself till the day I die, hopefully. That's what life's all about. So the successes now are, I have got enhanced wisdom. I've got an even, I think, better relationship with my children. I've got friends with relationships that are nourished and nurtured. I've got this capacity to immerse myself in a space of even greater beauty within nature. I've got the capacity to be able to share what I do in Kangaroo Valley with my clients and my guests in a way where it's about the energy exchange, not necessarily a physical exchange of a product. These are the successes, and these are the growths that have taken place. It's nurtured my relationship with special people in my life that encourages even greater, deeper, more meaningful conversations. Now, I can keep going. So is it failure? Absolutely not. It is success. And I'm so glad you brought it up, because and if you look at me now, I'm buzzing, I'm glowing, I'm very happy, very, very happy.
We have a question from a listener named Deborah. This is not at all along the lines of what we've been discussing, really, but it's still interesting. She noticed that there's been a lot less swearing in this season so far, and she wanted to know, are you a swearer?
No, I'm not. You know what? You're right. And it's just, we're only two episodes in. Well, I'm not a swearer, because that's not to say I don't swear. I think if you're going to swear, it has to have impact. And yet if it gets abused all the time, the impact is minimized.
Purposeful swearing.
Absolutely. So swearing can be very purposeful, but it needs to be, let's say, reserve it for impact. And I'm glad she's noticed that, because I was actually quite conscious of that too beforehand. Yeah, I didn't need to swear.
Yeah, fair enough. Mike, I feel like we could sit here and talk to you forever about all of these things, but we should move on. We've now got 10 quick-fire questions that we're asking all of our guests on the podcast.
Wow.
So quick question, quick answer, all right? We'll fire through them. Are you ready?
Let's go.
All right. First question. What's the best of your 10 items?
My axe.
My axe.
He says with me.
And my axe.
I have to shave it. Was that good?
Which item, if any, would you swap out?
None of them. None of them. I really spent a lot of time on, choosing my items very carefully. And I would, if I was to go out again tomorrow, I'd take the same 10 items with me.
What was your biggest mistake out there?
Do you know what? This is interesting. My biggest mistake, well, biggest learning in 48 hours was to make sure I put things down in the same place all the time. I'd sometimes use my knife, I'd put it on the ground, and because it had a black handle and the ground was so moist, I'd go, where's my knife? I went trekking, looking at game trails. I had my glasses in my back pocket, and it was only because I came back the same way I found my glasses on a rock.
Oh.
What was your biggest craving out there?
Okay, my biggest craving was to see game, to see deer.
All right, number five, would you rather sand flies or leeches?
Leeches, any day.
Who did you miss the most?
I miss the kids. I miss the kids the most.
Where did you tell your friends you were going?
On a really long holiday.
Did you actually?
Because it was winter time, and our season is such whereby we're really busy in spring, summer, autumn, and in winter, it's our time off.
Did you have a boot camp pick for the win?
No. No.
You're being diplomatic there?
No.
Would you do it again?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Tomorrow.
Well, he did it again.
Yes,
he went straight out and did it again.
I'd do it again. Yep.
What's one piece of advice that you'd give yourself if you could talk to you if you were going in now?
Be true to yourself. Stick to your guns. And don't fatten up for Christmas. There you go. The one advice I'd give myself in three parts.
Beautiful.
Mike, thank you so much for joining us. We're really sorry to see you gone from the show, but you're not forgotten, just like our next guest, Leanne.
He's a beautiful person. Yeah, I can't wait to catch up with everybody when it's all over and we get to share our real stories together.
Mate,
it's so important.
Thank you for your time.
No, thank you, mate.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Gina.
Need a few minutes to reset? Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Leanne is another participant who we farewelled in this episode. She's a proud Barkindji woman who grew up on country, foraging, fishing. She describes herself as a Nunya, or a stubborn or self-reliant person. But the pull of family was ultimately stronger for her than the will to stay. Leanne, thank you so much for joining us. First of all, I suppose let's just start at the beginning. Why did you want to go on the show?
The only thing that really pushed me was Rob, I guess. When he'd gone on this wonderful adventure, I was at home still working and with the kids. Kind of felt a little bit jealous that he was going on this, you know, wonderful little journey all for himself, you know. I wanted that. I wanted to have the same experience and I wanted to test myself, I guess. That was it. Like it stemmed from a little bit of jealousy watching Rob pack his stuff and go on this adventure. I wanted the same thing.
Understandable. You know, it's like, especially if you're at home with the kids and here is your partner going off on this fabulous adventure, it's like, when's it my turn?
Yeah. Look, we get so caught up doing, you know, it's routine. You get up, you go to work, you care for your family, and that's every day. Same thing. And sometimes you just want to shake it up a little bit. And I guess this was an opportunity to do that.
That's a bit of an understatement, isn't it? Shaking it up with Alone Australia.
Yeah, you really did. Yeah, you really shook it up too, didn't you? And I guess going from that, okay, I'm at home and I'm with the kids and I've seen Rob go through it and I've watched his whole journey. So you actually are in this amazing place of being able to learn from his journey. So how did you prepare? Like, how did you sort of take all of that and then make it yours so that you could have your adventure?
Growing up, we spent all our school holidays and weekends like either by the river or gone bush. So I kind of felt, yeah, I could do it. That wasn't going to be an issue. And I kind of thought, well, there are times when I'm out and I'm working alone and I enjoy it. I enjoy my own company. So I figured, yeah, I could do this too alone and it's not going to be an issue. But ultimately it is, because we are used to having our family, like they are your survival tool. We had 10 items we could take. If I could have taken my partner and my two kids, I'd have stayed there forever. It wouldn't have been an issue. But you've got to weigh up what's more important. And when I applied to do the show for the money. It was for the wrong reasons. I wanted the money. I wanted the money so that was a deposit for a bit of land. you know, land is everything. And I always say that, like, without it, we are nothing. We're not going to survive without land. Like, everything in it sustains us. If I could have land, then that's not just going to benefit me. It's going to benefit my close family, but my extended family as well. It's a place where everyone can go back to country and connect again, you know, and do the things that we used to do, which don't happen much anymore. We're slowly getting caught up in the everyday of having to go to work. Our lives revolve around work, and it shouldn't.
And I think that, you know, what you're talking about with family being your survival item, and it's something that I've noticed. I noticed it with Rob and I noticed it with Dwayne. I notice it with, especially with First Nations people, there's such a deep connection to mob and to family that is like an outcropping of the connection to country and can't be pulled apart. So the idea of actually surviving on country alone, it just makes no sense. How long did that take really before you started to like really understand that when you're out there?
You know when it really hit me? It hit me when the day before we were dropped and we visited the marae and we had that beautiful welcome to country, and it was all family. It was all family there welcoming us. And I was trying to hold back my tears through all the singing, through all the talk. Like, I was trying to hold back my tears because I started to miss my family. I mean, I was thinking, what am I doing here without my family? This is something I want to experience with my family. They're all family in front of me and I don't have mine here with me. It was that moment it actually hit me. The day before I even got dropped.
How long had it been since you'd seen your family at that point?
It had been 6 days already. No, that would have been the seventh day, I think. So I'd already been away from home about a week.
That's a long time for that rubber band to stretch. And going back to your time out in Aotearoa, one moment that I really loved when you were out there was when you recited that incredible poem about being part of country. And it really got me thinking that you come from red dirt and like open, dry country. That's your country. And then you get sort of like dropped into this country that's completely and utterly different, that is, it's not even on the same continent. And I guess what I wanted to know is, how does your country communicate with you and you with it? Like in your relationship with your own country, how do you receive those messages or how do you receive those communications from the country that is a part of you?
It's the smell, you know, the dry air and the smell of the dirt and the familiar trees and I don't know how to describe. I'm not great with describing words, but you just, you know, because you feel your heart filling up and I don't know, it's like recharging a battery, you know, when it's depleted and it just, you put it on the charger and it charges and it's good to go again. That's what being on country feels like, that you're familiar with, that you have a connection with, that talks to you. Like everything is living within country, you know, and you're a part of it. You're a part of that. It's not separate. You can't separate, you know, the people from the land. It's one. You can't separate the animals from the land. You can't separate the plants from the land. Like everything is connected. And, you know, we all need each other. We all need those things to survive and feel good.
You just painted such a beautiful picture of how it is to be on that familiar country that is your home country and is a part of you. And then you get put onto something that's completely different, where the birds don't sound the same and the trees don't smell the same and the water smells different. And here you are and you've landed. What was it like to receive the information, and what was your experience like of being in that completely unfamiliar place?
A little bit overwhelming. Like you had to just stop and breathe and try and take it all in. I've never seen trees that tall before. They were huge trees. Like you couldn't even hardly see the sky through those trees. There were so many of them. I was right next to like a stream, and just the sound of that constantly, like it was beautiful at first, but then after a while, it just, that constant noise of the water running over those rocks all the time started to get to me a little bit. When I arrived, there was this beautiful little fantail. I think it was a fantail. And it was hopping around, following me around everywhere. So I kind of felt really welcome. But then after a while, it left. So it welcomed me there, but then it left. And then I didn't see it again until the day I decided to leave. And then it came back. And it was really weird. It was almost like it was meant to be, like I'd made the right decision and it was my time. Like, it was weird, overwhelming. But beautiful. It's just different country to read. That's all. It's very different. And you've got to take your time. Like, you can't rush out. I didn't rush out to go hunting or do anything like that. I just kind of wanted to ground myself and familiarize myself with that place.
We actually have a question from a listener in WA called Bonnie along those lines. She wanted to ask, how far in advance did you find out that you were headed to New Zealand, and were you able to do any research before you went?
Like, it wasn't that long before we left. I don't know the exact.
I think it's only been like a week.
There's not a lot of time. Like, you could go and buy some books from the bookstore, but reading a book doesn't really teach you anything. Like, you learn by doing, hands-on. Physically seeing someone do something and then you trying it or tasting it. So, yeah, there's no way you could possibly prepare yourself to go to another country and survive from a book. No.
And yet, you know, all of us who are into Alone, when we first start watching it, we sit there and we, like, you know, shout at the TV and we think, yes, I could go there and I could do it. And then when you get there, it's a whole other story.
I would never think that. I'm constantly impressed and just awestruck by the resourcefulness and the people show out there in Alone, and also the courage to try it in the first place. I'm a self-confessed city boy, Leanne, and like, I think whether it's 1 day, 3 days, 40 days or over 60 days, like Gina, I'm just like, whoa, like all hands up. Like, you guys, amazing job.
Oh, look, it's definitely a mental game. I wasn't expecting that. I thought I could just go and I'd be okay and survive, but mentally, like, yeah, it just wasn't going to happen.
If you don't mind, just like talk us through how that mental aspect started to play out and what happened there.
I started to feel a little bit claustrophobic. And I found myself out on the lakeshore a lot and not wanting to go back into my campsite, not wanting to go back into where the trees were. Like, I started to, get a really yuck feeling, really. Yeah, it was like a claustrophobic feeling, like the trees were closing in on me and I just needed to get out of there.
Leanne, you opted not to bring a photo of Rob and the family, but you did bring a photo of your parents out there with you when you shared that photo with the audience, and that was a beautiful moment that we got to share with you. If you don't mind, would you tell us a little bit about your parents and why you think that they'd be telling you to go home to your family?
We were mum and dad's like priorities in life. We were their everything. And you hear people talk about unconditional love, you know, like their love was unconditional. It did not matter what we did or, you know, if we did silly things, they were always there to support us and, you know, help us to find our path, you know, in the right direction. They were never embarrassed or ashamed by us, or we could never do anything that would, you know, upset them. It was just pure love, and we were their everything. And, you know, just growing up, everything they did was so that we could have a better life. We did everything together. like always going bush, and it was always as a family. So I just felt like, you know, what am I doing? Like, I've left my family when I could actually be at home with them. I could be out bush at home with my kids instead of being here, starting to feel that horrible feeling come on, you know. I lost my mum when I was only 22 to cancer, and she was young. She was like in her mid-40s, and I'm like 42. And you don't know. Like, she didn't drink. She didn't smoke. She walked everywhere. She was fit and healthy. It just shouldn't have been that way. So the point is, you don't know when it's your time. You really don't know when it's your time, and you've just got to do what makes you happy and live life to the fullest and be there for your family.
And what we saw in the episode was that moment when you kind of had that aha moment about your mum and her age and you being about the same age. And it just seemed like everything came into focus, and you know, you had that realization of like, this is what's important. This is what's right for me. This is what I need to do. Then you come out of this experience and you've had a little bit of time now to kind of process. How have you been enriched by your time, you know, now that you've digested it a bit? How have you been enriched by your time on Alone, and what, if any, wisdom have you brought back for your family?
I don't know. I still have the same hopes. I still have the same dreams. Like, I still want land. And I don't know, like, I have some thoughts and ideas of things that I'd like to do, like just getting back out on country with family groups, just helping people connect again, I guess, you know. Look, my life does revolve around work, and that's because I'm very lucky to work, you know, on my part of country, on my grandmother's country, you know. I work in the Willandra Lakes World Heritage Area, and it's access to country, it isn't easy. You know, that place is 30% of it is Mungo National Park, which everybody has probably heard of, and the other 70% is like private leasehold land. So just having that access to country is really hard. And, yeah, I guess my dream is to create spaces where there is access for people, for community.
I can imagine it would have been a deeply intimate and such a personal moment when you finally got home and hugged your family. Could you share that, some of that, with us? What was that like when you did finally step foot back home in the house?
It was good. I was really worried about my little girl. And there's actually one story. Rob was telling me that a few days, like a few nights after I'd left, he was in bed reading her a story. And just out of nowhere, she's just done that whole... But there's no sound coming out. But it was like she was crying with no sound. And he's looked at her and he's gone, "What's wrong, darling? What's wrong?" And she's like, "I just don't know what to do. I miss my mum." Oh, and it broke my heart when Rob told me that story. Like, I just thought, oh, how could I have ever left?
Sometimes we have to go into the no to find the yes, don't we, though? That can be so true in life. Like, we don't really know until we test to find out that actually this isn't where I need to be. And then we know for sure where we actually do need to be. I had a question as well. Do you give Rob some stick because you lasted longer than him?
No, but he loves to bring it up. Like, you got to have a laugh about it, you know. Not everything is so serious, and, you know, it takes a lot of guts to just fill that application form in and hope that you get chosen. I honestly didn't think I'd have the opportunity. I filled the application out, which isn't an easy application. It is very long. It took me about a week because I did it a little bit here and a little bit there, and I guess you just got to throw your hat in the ring, don't you, and see what happens. If it wasn't for Rob applying for the first season, I would never have applied at all. So I've got to say thanks to Rob because he really pushed me and made me realise that I can do it.
So it's kind of like the family did 5 days rather than he did one and he did four.
Yeah, that's one way of looking at it. I'll have to tell him that one.
Yeah, great. Did he give you any advice going in?
Look, I think one of the things that he sort of said was don't let boot camp get you down. That was one really big thing because it is hard. At that week before you go in and you're doing boot camp and you're learning about all the things that you can and can't do, it's full on. Like that's early morning starts, late till late at night. I struggled through that to begin with. Just with the flight times, hardly any sleep. So it was like first day into boot camp, I had a headache and that lasted 2 days. I just couldn't get rid of it because my body was saying you need to rest. Like you've had no sleep, you need to just go and have a sleep, which is what I did for a whole afternoon. And I woke up feeling amazing after that. But, yeah, it's a full-on process. It's really full-on and it's draining.
And what have you got coming up next, Leanne? What's on the horizon for you now?
Not sure. I've got some ideas, but who knows? I'd love to travel some more and I'd love to go back over to New Zealand to the South Island and, take my family. Such a beautiful place. I want to enjoy it with them.
That sounds awesome.
We've got what we called a quick fire round. It's basically 10 questions for you where we'll just kind of, Gina and I will bounce between the questions and then you just give like your quick answer, bang, 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 bang. So are you ready to do it? Ready. First question, Leanne, what was the best of your 10 items?
Oh, my God, I don't know, my ferro rod.
Which item would you swap out, if any?
I wouldn't have changed anything.
What was your biggest mistake?
Walking on the rocks in the stream, that was really stupid. They're so slippery, yeah.
What was your biggest craving?
Steak.
Would you rather sand flies or leeches?
Leeches.
Who did you miss the most?
My daughter and my son, because I was thinking about my son a lot while I was out there, thinking, oh, this would be great to be doing it with him.
Where did you tell your friends you were going?
I didn't tell everybody I was even going, but the couple of people I did tell, I just kind of said, I'm going to be away for work and I'm going to be in a really remote location, so I'm not going to be contactable. But, you know, just contact Rob and he'll pass the message on and I'll try and call you when I can.
Who was your boot camp pick for the win?
Everyone has, you know, a unique way of doing things. Everyone has something different to bring. I didn't think about it as a competition. I just kind of thought about it as a bit of an adventure, and if I won, then that was great. But yeah, it's not like I was competing against anyone.
Would you do it again? Would you do that adventure again?
I would, yeah. I still would do it again.
What's one piece of advice that you'd give yourself now?
Don't let the mental side get to you.
That's a beautiful message, I think, to end our chat. Leanne, thank you so much for joining us, for giving us your time. I think, I know I certainly did. I learned a lot from experiencing that along with you through the TV set about family, about connection to land, to country. So, look, thanks for joining us and thanks for sharing your thoughts with us here and also with a national audience for Alone Australia Season 2.
Thanks for having me.
And I just wanted to say thank you for showing what it looks like when you listen to your own internal authority and decide to leave on your own terms. And I think that that's something that in a world where so many of us do things for other people, it's really good to see a powerful woman who can listen to what's right and make that choice and stand by it. And I have learned a lot from you as well. Thank you, Leah.
Thanks, Gina. I guess it's easy to sit on your couch and judge other people, but you never know until you give it a go.
Thanks for joining us on this podcast. If you'd like to get in touch, email alonepodcast@sbs.com.au and use the hashtag AloneAustralia on socials. Follow us on your podcast app to catch all the upcoming episodes when they drop, and we'll see you after the next episode. Alone Australia, the podcast, is produced by SBS Audio, Carolyn Gates, Max Gosford, Joel Supple and Karen Okuda. Special thanks to Joseph Maxwell, ITV, Alone Australia's executive producer, Rima Dayer, and, of course, all the participants.